If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board while Will Erskine booking the guests in the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. It is budget day. But at the end of the day, we pretty much already know what it's all about, because the Prime Minister spent, since the end of last month, just over 2 weeks, day by day, unloading another bonbon and telling us how many billions of dollars he's going to spend. I guess, hopefully, what comes now is how do you pay for it all? And many have said they're going to raise the taxes on the rich. That always, isn't that populist politics? Isn't that populist politics, what they called those on the right wing? You know, tax the rich, save the planet, ban guns. Isn't that all sort of, you know, populist politics, but on the left? Either way, taxing the rich in business, which is really concerning to a lot of people, because the Bank of Canada said, break the glass. This is an emergency. Our productivity, our investment, our innovation is down. We're just sucking off the credit card, and we're doing nothing, not only to pay it back, but to even have a job to earn enough money to pay it back. It's kind of, the government is kind of like you trying to, you know, find a home. You know, you just keep getting mired and mired and mired in more and more debt. And it looks like this afternoon at 4 o'clock, and we'll keep an eye on it. It's how do you pay for it all? Which taxing the rich? I don't know. There's rich people, but they usually have rich accountants that help them alleviate all of this. And you know, I'm not a rich guy. I have no idea what it's like to make over $250,000 a year. No idea. But if I did, I would not want to be giving over 50% of it away to the government. And I'd be doing everything I could to keep it in my pocket. And, you know, I'm just a middle class trying to hang on to it like the rest of you. So it's fancy. It's been fancy dancing for the last couple of weeks. And the Liberals are convinced it's not about the policy. It's that you're just not getting it. You're not getting it. They've even asked the banks to say, no, don't, that's not a carbon tax rebate. That's something different. I mean, again, you can change the message all you want. You can deliver it, you can deliver the same message any way you want. If the message remains the same and people aren't happy with the policy or where they are in life as a result of it, or the person driving the bus, it is what it is. So I'm not sure, you know, and everybody says, oh, how grand it's been. They've captured the media's attention. And the strategy is brilliant for someone who it's going to work for. But in the end of the day, after 2.5 weeks of listening to this, it's just like another reminder again today. Yep, you're monopolizing the news cycle. But I'm not feeling any better about it. Is anybody else? So I think they can stop saying that their message is not being heard loud and clear. I think we all get it. We get the rebate. But when you're trying to explain things to people by saying, if we cut the tax, you don't get the rebate, that shows you who we're thinking or who they're thinking of. And they call that, when referring to the right, as the low information voter. Well, who else thinks that, wow, they cut the tax, I will get a rebate? Who thinks that's good planning? I mean, seriously. So all that, inflation ticked up another notch, 2.9%. Nothing to really be afraid of. It's still sitting. It was from 2.8 in March. It's up to 2.9. I'm sure, again, that's not going to help what the government's going to try to throw down a little later on today. But, you know, again, I'm sure we're going to hear the phrase over and over and over and over again, the middle class and those trying to join it. Well, I think it's time the middle class took a step back and realized that this government has decimated the middle class. And you don't have to believe me. Just ask your kids if they can buy a house, or their kids, or whoever. Because if that is not if that's not proof you haven't decimated the middle class, what is? So at the end of the day, where's the minister of the middle class? Where's this government been on any of this? And now all of a sudden, oh, we've changed the needle now. We've changed the needle. We're pointing in this direction. And we're going to deliver a budget that is fair. Fair to who? The people that you roped into voting for you, the young people who now can't afford a home? It's like they're targeting little groups trying to win back what they've lost over the last 8 years with their NDP liberal brand of socialism. And that's what it is. He is slowly taking the country farther and farther and farther to the socialist left. So anybody who's in the right, or in the center rather, looks like they're in the right, extreme right. So it's just insane how you can go back to the trough again and literally scrape the bottom of the barrel and try to throw it out in front of us and sell it like it's something different. It's not the communication. It's the message. Canadians don't like the policy or the leader. So we'll see. As David Dodge, former Bank of Canada head, said, this is the worst budget since 1982, which was that of Pierre Elliott Trudeau. And he's got some heavy-duty, he's got a heavy-duty resume, heavy-duty credentials. So it's going to be fascinating. We'll see how we pay for it all coming up just over an hour from now. It is all coming up on the show. We've heard the news about Tesla and layoffs. Does this speak of the EV industry or just a company that is struggling? Let's bring in Marvin Ryder, professor at Groot School of Business, McMaster University. He's here now. Marvin, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Glad to be with you.
Before we get started on the EV thing, Marvin, your thoughts on budget coming down. What do you think we're going to hear today? Do you think we're going to hear how it's all paid for?
Well, Chrystia Freeland has announced that she's capping the maximum budget deficit at $40 billion. That doesn't seem like much of a cap to most of us, but she's committed to that. So the question really, the one thing that's unknown is whether there's going to be any new taxes. Now, I think the average person listening to us has nothing to worry about here, but it's conceivable the Liberal government could roll out some tax increases for high earners meaning people who make $500,000 or more. There may be a new tax rate for them. There may also be what they call an excess profit tax on some businesses. Now, how you determine at what level you get excess profits is beyond me, but the idea is there are some companies that are doing very well. Maybe they should pay more. Nobody's talked about that in the run-up. Otherwise, I think in terms of spending, you've heard the big issues. It's going to be about housing. It's going to be about defense spending. We haven't had a budget in Canada that focused on defense in many, many, many years. And again, you can credit this to climate change. Thanks to the changes in climate, the Arctic is no longer as full of ice as it once was. And suddenly that means we need to get some boats up there to protect our interests in the north. And there'll be a few other small things. But I think you've heard all the spending goodies in advance. The question is going to be, are there a couple of tax surprises?
How do you balance that, especially with business, when we hear from the Bank of Canada that productivity, investment, innovation is down?
Yeah, so again, I won't be surprised if they re-announce a number of programs. So governments typically will announce a program, but it'll be funded over 5 years. Today, they get one announcement, but next year they'll re-announce it and they'll keep re-announcing it every year. So certainly the government is interested in spending money on R&D that leads to productivity improvements, AI that leads to productivity improvements. And they've already committed some funds, and I think it's not going to be net new spending. It's going to be re-announcements of what they've already put in a five-year plan starting last year.
All right, let's talk Tesla. Is this say anything about EV sales, or is this about a company that's struggling?
Well, I think it's more about a company that's struggling, but let me see if I can give a little context to this. EVs, now when we say EVs, we usually add the word battery electric vehicles. They run completely on batteries. Had a great year in 2023. In the United States, they sold more than 1.2 million units. That's up considerably. I think it's up nearly 30% from the year before. So, wow, that's amazing. But the problem is that there's another product on the market that's doing even better, and that's hybrid vehicles. They use a combination of batteries and gasoline power. Last year in the United States, 1.6 million of those units. Now, Tesla, we think of as the king or queen of the electric vehicle market space, but it has no hybrid vehicles at all. And what we're finding is consumers at this moment in 2024 and in 2023 are really worried about infrastructure around electric vehicles. They're not worried about the vehicle themselves. Most people say, I see that as a solid, reliable technology. But when I go to charge my vehicle, where can I find a charging station? I don't know if he has spoken to you directly, Scott, but a famous Greater Hamiltonian by the name of Ron Foxcroft was attending the NCAA tournament in Phoenix, Arizona. He rented a battery-powered Ford Mustang and loved every driving it until he had to return it to the auto repair auto rental company. And to recharge the battery, it took 9 hours because there were no fast chargers anywhere near his hotel. That has going to make him a little leery about doing that again.
So what does Tesla do moving forward? Do they expand into that transition industry? Do they perhaps sell to another car company? Many thought that they would as soon as they really started to take off and blazed a trail in this industry. What's next for them?
Well, actually, almost anything is possible, Scott. So again, if I look forward now, by 2035, all vehicles sold in Canada are to be zero emission vehicles. That could be battery vehicles. It could also be hydrogen powered vehicles. Who knows? And the line to get from here, 2024 to 2023, is not perfectly straight. Meaning there's going to be ebbs and flows. I think electric vehicles will still be a big part of all of this. All the world's car companies are spending billions, and that's with an S, billions of dollars on trying to solve two big problems. One, the amount of charge you have between needing to recharge. In other words, right now you go about 300, 400 kilometers. Consumers say, well, I'll be more interested when you can get to 600, 700 kilometers. And the other is this time it takes to recharge the battery. Right now it takes 20 to 30 minutes. Most people would like it to be a fill up at the gas station around 5 minutes. I don't see either of those as insurmountable. So as they keep working on this and they make adjustments, I think its fortunes are going to improve. Tesla itself is also working on that. Interestingly, just earlier this week, the vice president in charge of batteries has resigned. And the argument seemed to be that Elon Musk was not happy with the progress that he was making on coming up with the next generation of batteries. So I think it's going to be a little fits and starts as it goes, but I'm not worried about Tesla and I'm not worried about EVs. They will still be a big part of the market over the next decade.
Will Tesla continue or will they move more towards, as they are, I guess, since the beginning of this, into the R&D aspect of this as opposed to actually mass producing the vehicles?
Well, I think they're going to be doing both. And so the biggest problem Tesla, as you asked at the beginning, is this a problem of Tesla? For many years, it was the lone wolf. It had the market all to itself. Over the last year and a half, we've seen every other major car company introduce electric vehicles in the market and in different markets. So Tesla is just now entering the Indian market. My God, that's the third largest car market in the world, and you're only getting around to doing that now. And when they go in, they're not the lead player anymore. So with all that increased competition, something we saw 9 months ago was that Tesla cut its prices on new vehicles. This was unheard of. You know, you pay $20,000 more for a Tesla than an average other vehicle. Well, they've cut that because they're facing this competition. And that's really the interesting question. Is Elon the guy to take this into the next generation when you have to get down in the trenches, elbow to elbow, and duke it out? The skill you had when you were the technology leader may not be there when you have to compete head to head with the others. So I think there's still going to be some ebbs and flows. But at this moment, Tesla is still there.
Marvin Ryder, professor at the Groot School of Business, McMaster University, and the success of Tesla. Thank you, Marvin. As always, be well.
I will. Thank you.
All right. Lots of chatter about PharmaCare plan, dental plans, and we've talked about this in the past, and we've heard many, whether it's dentists or associations, say the provinces have a pretty good plan. The problem is we can't get it to everybody because there's just not enough money for it. Is that the answer, refunding these plans or coming up with a national plan? And the questions are starting to arise. Dr. Brock Nicolucci with us, president of the Ontario Dental Association, and here now. Brock, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Thank you, Scott, for having me.
So let's start with where this is now, where this plan is now. What do we have now?
What do we have right now? We have an interim dental benefit plan that's due to expire, and we have, coming in May, the Canadian Dental Care Plan about to be launched. But, you know, there's a lot of concerns with them that the provincial and territorial dental associations have, and hopefully government is listening to us and going to make the right adjustments so that most dentists in Canada can partake in this program.
So what are the concerns? Because you would think if the dental associations, you're the first ones they're going to go to for consultation. What are the concerns?
Well, the biggest concern we're having right now is they want us to sign a contract that they can unilaterally change. And I don't know about you, Scott, but I was always raised that, you know, you don't ever sign a contract like that. And that just, and there's a lot of difficult terms and conditions associated with that. And it's really going to put a lot of problems into the program.
Is this about making sure everybody's under one plan, or is it making sure those that don't fit under a plan have one?
This is for the 1/3 of Canadians that don't have access to dental benefits in Canada. So people that don't fall under the provincial or private dental plans. So there's a lot. There's 9 million people that this plan is going to affect, but we need it to affect them properly, not where they're, it's going to be another failed federal program.
We've heard from various associations, dentists, whatever, that have said, you know, the programs the provinces have are pretty good. They're just not funded the way they need to be well executed. Is that accurate?
Actually, that is accurate in Ontario, and that's actually why right now the Ontario Dental Association is sitting down with the Ontario government, because there's been such a poor funding for the program that very few dentists partake in the program.
So why not just use the plan that your association and the Ontario dentists or those in any provinces have come up with and fund it, as opposed to creating a whole new level of plan, bureaucracy, what have you?
Well, each provinces have their own different plans that the provincial government put out. So the federal government wanted to address the 1/3 of Canadians that don't have any access to any dental plans. And this is a great initiative, and all Canadian dentists, like the Dental Association, are behind this 100%. But the problem is that there's these, for example, I gave you the contract, you know, but there's administration burdens. And, you know, I'll give you an example. Let's say a patient comes into pain and they need a root canal. Well, we have to make sure that the tooth follows all these guidelines before we can do it. And if they don't, then we have to send a pre-authorization off. Whereas if you have a private dental care plan and you need a root canal, I see you right away. Why is it fair that someone has to be sent off to wait to get treated for a root canal when people with private dental insurance and provincial dental insurance or dental plans have the ability to be seen right away?
Why are they doing this, in your opinion?
You know, unfortunately, the Provincial and Territorial Dental Associations were brought to this at the 11th hour, and we keep on raising these concerns that there are too many administration burdens, and this is just one example. And, you know, I don't know why they're doing it. We've raised the concern, but, you know, they're trying to work on it, from our understanding, but still we have no move in that area. We did have a good meeting last week with Minister Holland. He understands this. He wants to try and make it work, and we want to help Health Canada with their dental plan. But, you know, it's just another example. You know, dental staff are my office right now. You know, people always ask me, Dr. Nicolich, are you going to be signing up for this program? And I said, you know, it's not a question of whether I am. It's a question of whether my staff wants me to. And right now, my dental staff does not want me doing this, because it's a lot of extra work for patients that don't really need to go through this. I mean, we should be trying to make a plan that is seamless so patients could come in and get treated fairly.
Did the minister have answers for your concerns? I mean, working on it, okay, yeah.
And, you know, that's the concern we have. He acknowledged the concerns we have and wants to take it back. So, you know, right now it was a good meeting. What's going to come from it? I guess, you know, the devil's in the details. So we're waiting to see what comes about this.
Has anybody been given any timeline on this? As you know, I mean, because obviously you're getting patients who are coming to your place, knocking on your door and looking for answers, and you can't really give them yet. Has there been any timeline?
The only timeline we have is that this is supposed to start in May, but But as I had a patient in today, you know, wanting to give up their private dental insurance, he said, you know, he had said, Brock, what do you think I should do? And I said, you know, here's the questions I have. This is the questions that the staff has. You know, what do you think? And he says, well, why would I ever give up my insurance? I mean, this obviously doesn't even seem as good as what I have, and I have to pay a lot of money into it. And I said, I'm just letting you make your own decision, but these are the concerns we have with it. And he says he's very frustrated, actually, with the government. He says, why wasn't the government working with you guys on this earlier?
So if you had an ear and a wish list here, Brock, how would you move forward with this? What would you do?
You know, the first of all, the Provincial and Territorial Dental Association put forward a plan that was more cost effective than the plan that's on the table right now. But with the federal dental plan, remove the registration process. I mean, no dentist should have to register for this plan. That's really the problem. And these certain things that are affecting, you know, the administration burden. You know, our staff right now, they're overworked. They don't need extra work. Let's try and make it as seamless as possible.
Is that why your system is more cost effective? Is because there isn't the administration burden that you're seeing with this?
There is. That's part of it. But also the plan is not as rich. You know, certain things aren't as, there's limited frequencies. There's a whole bunch. We provided a white paper that we sent off to the government earlier last year, and that was outlined in it and everything.
So where do you go from here? You wait till May to see what happens next?
No, we were assured by Minister Holland that we'd be getting an answer to some of our concerns. But again, the devil's in the details. If they're planning on creating an alternate pathway, but if they're going to have an alternate pathway with the same erroneous terms and conditions, what's the purpose of having an alternate pathway that just puts the dentist in the same position? You know, the problem is a unilateral contract. I mean, that's just, I don't know what you feel about that, but I really do have a hard time with that.
Do you think there'll be peace in the valley with this? Because there's more than one province here.
And the great thing is that the provinces are all united together from coast to coast to coast. We all share the same concerns, and we all want to champion this in. We all want Canadians to have access to a fair dental care plan.
Dr. Brock Nicolucci with us, president of the Ontario Dental Association, with some concerns over the federal dental care plan. Brock, thanks so much for the time. Good luck.
Thank you. Have a great day.
This is bizarre. NASA confirmed Monday that a mystery object that crashed through the roof of a Florida home last month was a chunk of space junk from equipment discarded from the International Space Station. I'm still not convinced it was just a wayward bowling trophy that flew out of someone's mobile home during a tornado, but you never know. Let's bring in Paul Delaney, Professor Emeritus, Faculty of Science, Department of Physics and Astronomy, York University, here now. Paul, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am indeed, Scott, and it definitely wasn't a bowling trophy.
So, you know, the first thing I thought of, Paul, when I heard of this before I read the story, I thought, remember that guy that lost the tool when he was going out on a spacewalk? Maybe it's that, or somebody's phone, or what have you. But you go ahead and tell us what happened here and the mystery.
So what happened is back in, I guess it was March of 2021, NASA discarded a battery pack. So the International Space Station, of course, has got both solar panels, which directly generates energy for the space station. But of course, when they go into darkness, they're charging batteries so that the space station continues to operate. The space station has been up there for now 24 years and counting. And so not surprisingly, some of the stuff ages and gets discarded. Well, in 2021, they discarded a bank of batteries and the platform on which the batteries were located. And the plan was for it to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere 2 or 3 years down the road and burn up completely so that basically it disintegrates and everybody's happy. Well, in this particular instance, the NASA and the various agencies around the planet were continuing to track this piece of space junk because it was a pretty big piece of space junk, and they expected it to re-enter in early March of this year. And the best estimate was that it was going to burn up over the Gulf of Mexico. Most of it did, but not all of it. And a piece of it, a few centimeters long, about, roughly speaking, half a kilogram, closer to a kilogram, actually, did make it through the atmosphere. It wasn't one of the batteries. It was actually one of the support beams, one of the support struts. and it went through this poor guy's roof and created a bit of a mess and embedded itself in his floor. Not cool, to say the very least, but that's what happened. It was a piece of derelict material thrown overboard from the International Space Station 3 years ago.
How do you confirm such a thing? Because I think most people's reaction would be something off an airplane.
Well, fair enough. This particular one, there are some images that you can see. It's definitely very, very badly charred from the reentry process. And I'm betting that there must have been some inscription of some description on the actual strut itself, which gave pause to the individual who found it in his floor. And that's when he was thinking, oh, this must be from NASA. Because as well, we announced, it was public knowledge that this piece of debris was re-entering on March 8th. And I think he put two and two together and said,
right,
debris coming down, it's ended up in my roof. But there's, as I said, bound to be some sort of inscription on it as well.
Obviously, then, of course, that's other than something flying through your roof at this velocity, which we obviously know could be incredibly dangerous, is this piece contaminated in any way? Is there any danger?
No, as I said, it was one of the struts. It basically was like a piece of iron that came plowing through his roof. So no contamination in that regard. The speed was certainly significant. We're not talking thousands of kilometers an hour here. This was at terminal velocity, but punching through your roof at a couple of hundred kilometers an hour is still pretty good speed.
Yeah, yeah.
Fortunately, nobody was home, or at least his son was either on the property or near the property, but nobody was hurt during the event. This is not unusual, though, unfortunately, Scott. We've seen instances of this sort of thing, not coming through somebody's roof, but landing on people's property increasingly over the last few years.
What does this say about space junk and the ability we have or haven't to get rid of it?
We're not doing a good job at all. Now, in this particular instance, we threw it deliberately overboard from the International Space Station. You can bet that NASA is going to be rethinking that policy going forward for these sorts of things. But rocket booster parts and rockets ascending into low Earth orbit, unfortunately, all of this is dropping debris around the planet. And as I said, several instances in the U.S., in China, as well as those are the two principal ones at the moment that I can think of, have occurred in the last few years. We are not doing as good a job as we could with respect to mitigating this problem. The more stuff we put into orbit, the better the chance is of stuff coming down. And imagine, if you will, this thing plowing through an aircraft that's flying at sort of, 10,000 meters. That would be absolutely catastrophic. So we do need to do a better job. And almost every space agency realizes this. It's just that we don't seem to be doing it as rapidly as we should, improving our situation as rapidly as we should.
Only got about 30 seconds left, Paul. Does that mean we need to be more efficient at burning these things up, or just not doing it in the first place?
Both. We know that we can burn up the small stuff, and we shouldn't be leaving behind bigger stuff in Earth orbit in the first place. So, we need to do a better job on both counts.
Paul Delaney, Professor Emeritus, Faculty of Science, Department of Physics and Astronomy, York University, always looking up. Paul, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Okay. Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer.
He'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
StatsCan released its March inflation numbers today, and we remember last month inflation sitting at 2.8%. It's only ticked up a sliver to 2.9%, but that's certainly not the direction that we want to be going in, even if it's staying flat. We figure now the reasons behind this: rising fuel prices. Dan McTagg with us, President of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP with us now. Dan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing fine, except consumers out there who are finally realizing you don't take energy prices for granted like the federal Liberals do.
Many saw housing keeping this up high in the last few of these announcements, and now we're moving to energy. Are you surprised with this in any way?
I'm surprised that it wasn't 3.3%, but it tells me that everything else is sinking because of a sinking economy, people losing their jobs, our tradespeople not being able to make ends meet, plumbers, steam fitters, electricians, take your pick. It's a bad situation. Single moms, everyone's having a tough go of it. And when you have a government that says it's okay to lard on 25 cents a liter to the price of gasoline, block pipelines, Scott, which you and I talked about, which adds another 26 cents a liter because of the weakness in the Canadian dollar, which weakens today, and a federal government that believes that it's okay to go out and increase the debt in the nation while producing absolutely nothing except virtue signaling and making its friends rich, particularly climate groups that get tens of millions of dollars from the federal government to continue to lecture us. Is it any wonder we haven't seen 3.3%? Next month, let me go on a limb here. We are going to see 3.5% inflation because year over year, the gulf will get greater. And of course, with that bad news, I am also known for my gas price predictions up 7 to 8 cents a liter on Thursday. So as if the situation isn't bad, the switch over to summer gasoline is going to make a bad situation worse for most of us.
I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway, Dan. Bank of Canada saying our productivity's down, break the glass, our innovation's down, investment is down. They're talking about taxing business in the budget that is coming out as we speak. But we have seen the government reverse things on the 413 here in Ontario. They were doing everything to stop the Ford government from building that. Now, all of a sudden, boom, it's going ahead. So I don't know. Could we all of a sudden see some change of direction here just simply because we need the cash?
Well, it can't be governments doing this. And when you invest billions of dollars into electric vehicles that no one wants to buy, which no one can afford, and for which the technology is likely to change. You know, Scott, I worked for Toyota many years ago, public relations. They're not going to use lithium batteries, nor are we going to see a province, you know, be successful in the battery storage field, because all these things are extraordinarily expensive. They produce very little wind of energy, and no one, if they don't like them, that's one thing, but they can't afford the kind of hydro costs that are associated with it. Listen, this is a province here that had to take a $10.3 billion write down deficit. Because it's paying over $10 billion every year to protect us from green energy hitting us with 32 cents a kilowatt hour electricity. Let me make that very clear. 32 cents a liter electricity is what you should be paying thanks to green energy, which we think is so cool and trendy. It's all fun and games, Scott, until people wind up actually having to pay for it. And that's why I think it's critical people get, we have actually a just transition, a reset in this country. We line up those folks that have pushed these green policies on the 30-yard line and punt them right through the end zone.
Your thoughts as a former Liberal MP of the budget strategy, doing it day by day since actually this started last month. It's been over 2 weeks that they've been doing this. And then obviously the budget today, delivering it all, rolling it all out day by day to keep the news cycle there. So your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I mean, you got a lot of money on proposals and ideas, but you've created a condition by which nobody wants to invest. Nobody can afford to buy. You know, it's nice for the federal government to talk about billions of dollars to build homes. The frank reality is that the same ministers who are supposedly making these announcements are responsible for migration, in which we unfairly brought far too many people into the country who can't find places, created a bit of a housing crisis with low interest rates, which the same governor of the Bank of Canada said would be lower for longer. We hoodwinked people. Look, there's, you can finally say, you know, I know a lot of people say, oh, you can't blame governments for everything. No, actually, you can. What this government has done, and I say this as a Liberal member of Parliament of 18 years, 1993 to 2011, much of what we're seeing today in terms of the decline of this country has everything to do with policies that have run against the very things that make our country unique and it makes it tick, whether that's energy, forestry, mining, agriculture. Take your pick. We've basically done whatever we could to spike every one of those industries that have a lot to do with making our economy prosperous and making life a little bit more affordable. So yes, at the end of the day, this is a government thing, and people here in Hamilton have a choice next time. NDP Liberal, good luck. You can't afford it.
How do we get through the next year and a half? I mean, if you're the Liberal Party and this falls flat in the next week or two, which we assume it will, because it certainly hasn't generated much interest to date, what's the next step as a party?
Well, I think for Canadians, it's grind and grimace. For the Liberal Party, I really can't say much about it. I think its days are numbered, but I suspect that the next 20 months are going to be a lot worse than the kind of damage we've seen and the fall in our economic outlook and our positiveness about this country that we've seen over the past few months. I think it's only going to get worse, the accelerating to the downside. I would expect, by the way, as a result of this budget, that we could actually hear grumblings of a credit downgrade for Canada. If that happens, then, you know, kiss goodbye the idea that we might actually get relief on the interest rate side. I hope that isn't the case, but I've seen this play before.
Dan McTagg with us, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP, talking about StatsCan releasing its March inflation report. We're up to 2.9 from 2.8, reason being fuel. Dan, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
It's a pleasure. Thanks again, Scott.
A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Tim Hortons has now made the jump to pizza. Remember McDonald's and pizza? It's part a move to stretch the brand into afternoon and nighttime. How far do you stretch the brand before it snaps? Let's ask Bruce Winder, retail analyst and author, retail before, during, and after COVID-19. He's here now. Bruce, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, I'm doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me on the program.
So I guess that restaurateurs, retailers of all sort are always trying to push the envelope, find other ways to create revenue, stretch the brand per se. How do you decide how far to go outside the wheelhouse here? How do you make the jump from coffee and donuts to pizza?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm sure that Tim's has studied this very carefully. I know they tested it for a couple of years. Even the Tim's I go to just down the street, you know, they've tested it and I've tried the pizza. But it's a real tough one. It's a fine line, right? Because every retailer is looking for increased revenue and profits, particularly for Tim's around the dinner hour. But they know that if they stretch it too far, it's going to hurt the brand. The brand is going to be diluted and people are going to be confused. So it's a very fine line to walk.
So is the product like a pizza or is it something like a pizza that they call a pizza?
Well, it's like flatbread pizza. You know, if you've ever been to a restaurant, it's like flatbread. So, you know, I thought it tasted pretty good. I didn't have a problem with it a couple of years ago when I tried it. But, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, you know, knowing that sort of the dark cloud of McDonald's foray into pizza a couple decades ago, you know, got people thinking. But, you know, this actually could work.
So trying to move into a dinner menu, is that accurate or is that pushing it too far? Because if you're going into pizza, why not burgers? Why not everything else?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's an opportunity there because Tim's is majorly under-indexed. They're huge in breakfast and lunch, missing a lot in dinner. You know, they're trying it. The risk is a little lower. They have more capacity at the restaurants. There's less traffic. So they can try it out, even if they pick up some incremental dollars, you know. Right now, they don't have that business. So as long as it doesn't dilute the brand too much, you know, and the product delivers in terms of taste and wait time and things of that nature, you know, it could actually be a good thing for them.
Do you think around the boardroom table at Tim's International, they've said, I got it, Tim's Burgers?
Well, you know, what's funny is Tim's tried a burger a couple of years ago. I think it might have been before the pandemic or just after. With a veggie burger. They tried a veggie burger, and I don't think that worked out too well for them. Now, that's different than a genuine beef burger, but that might be even more of a departure because a flatbread pizza is almost like a sandwich. You know, it's in the sandwich family, kind of. But if you go to a, you know, a grilled burger or something, that is an even bigger departure, I would argue.
Why not do breakfast well? I mean, you know, move into like what some of the other diners are doing. Is that of appeal to them or does it got to be out of a drive-through window?
Well, that's just it. A good chunk of their business, I don't know what, but probably a very good chunk of their business is drive-through. So, you know, that works for them. And they need people go to Tim's because they want to get in and out relatively quickly, right? They don't want to sit down for 4 hours and have a nice breakfast. So, you know, it's probably not their business model. Their business model is more to keep doing what they're doing in breakfast. They're probably almost saturated breakfast. Big opportunity for them is dinner. That's where they underplay so much. And there's only room to grow, I think, in the dinner hour for them.
Whatever happened to McDonald's and their pizza?
Well, they yanked it after a few years. They had problems with the delivery time. It took like 11 minutes to cook the pizza, and people were sitting around. And supposedly some people didn't like the taste. I mean, it's tough to go head to head with the pizzerias, right? You know, they're going to smoke you. They're so good at it and they taste so well. They've got that business down to a science. So real tough to go head on. At least they've sort of went adjacent to it with the flatbread pizza, which is a little bit different than head on comparison.
And you think that would be a lot quicker too?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think they're able to do a little quicker, you know, versus a full on pizza. I guess they've tested it. I mean, that'll be a challenge to make sure that they have it ready for the drive-through, though, because people aren't going to wait too long in the drive-through. So they're going to have to either prepare some in advance or be really quick, be able to make it super quick from start. And either way, it's a little more challenging than probably what they offer now.
All right. So it seemed, and you might remember this, Bruce, remember back in the day, there were pizzerias. There were restaurants that were dedicated just to the pizza. And of course, they brought other things into it as well as they fit. But it seemed that pizza's now gone from what was a gourmet kind of dinner thing to just like a fast food thing now.
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit of both, but you're right. It used to be going to sit down at a pizzeria and, you know, it was really nice. Even Pizza Hut, you know, I don't know if you call that a high-end pizzeria, but they got rid of a lot of their sit-down stores. Now Pizza Hut, you have to kind of take it with you. But that's right. Pizza's been a bit more commoditized. A lot of people eat it on the run. A lot of people got it during the pandemic. But it's really been sort of commoditized now, and it's less probably of a sit-down meal and more of sort of a food-on-the-go meal, quick-service meal.
Obviously, that sort of thing would not fly now, an Italian restaurant geared towards the pizza. We even remember the Chicago-style pizza stuff, the deep dish, all of that.
Oh, yeah. I used to love Mother's. I worked for Mother's as a delivery driver in 85. But no, you know what? That's probably harder to do unless you're really premium. You need to have your price points high in order to make money with a sit-down restaurant. So you'd have to order a gourmet pizza. You'd have to offer a gourmet-type pizza that's like 50, 60 bucks.
All right. So what about the McRib? Did it have is it a novelty? Do people actually like this to keep bringing it back or testing it or doing this or the other?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure. I mean, McDonald's is pretty notorious for coming out there and rotating things in their menu. You know, they try a lot of stuff. Hats off to them. They often use London, Ontario as a test market for their North American divisions. But they're always trying new things. And that's what they have to keep doing because they've been in business so long. They're saturated, right? They've got to keep new items coming in so people keep coming to their restaurants.
But still growing?
Well, you know what? McDonald's is still growing. Yep, believe it or not, it's come out of the pandemic looking pretty good. They do an enormous amount of business through their drive-through. And, you know, they're in the U.S., they're actually launching a small prototypical McDonald's. That's going to change everything. So they're evolving as society evolves as well.
So what happens when you're a donut and coffee place that's been branded as that? You're pretty much, lunch breaks or coffee breaks or such. I mean, is it asking too much to extend that to after 6 o'clock or to 6 o'clock?
Yeah, it's going to be, the proof will be in the pudding. You know, I'm assuming their test results went well for them to roll it out because it's a gutsy move to roll this out, right? It's not without controversy and not without history. I guess they're banking on it. I guess the risk is reasonably low because their dinner business is low right now. So even if they can add a little bit, you know, it's plus dollars they don't have right now. So I think the bigger risk is just to their brand, you know, in terms of dilution and time will tell what happens there.
Is pizza enough at this time? Should they be introducing a new sandwich menu, something to complement this?
Yeah, I think you can still use some of the sandwiches, you know, for dinner, but I think one step at a time. If they go too much into it, that's going to really confuse people. Pizza's like one of the biggest dinner hour type meals that consumers order. So, you know, if they're going to start with number one, the biggest category, see what happens. If that works, then you never know. They might be able to expand it.
Do you think pizza and coffee goes?
Not really, no.
Really,
like when you think pizza and coffee. No, I don't.
I'm thinking, and a free thing of Tums on the way out the door. I mean, it's just it's an odd dance.
Yeah, it's great for Sunday morning after a great party the night before. But it's kind of a funny. It's kind of a funny odd combination. But weirder things have worked, you know. So time will tell and see how Canadians accept it.
That's a good point. Bruce Winder with us, retail analyst and author, Retail Before, During, and After COVID-19. Tim Hortons Pizza. Bruce, thanks for the time. Be well.
Yeah, you too, Scott. Anytime. Take care.
Budget out slowly. Pretty much know most of it, but dribs and drabs coming out now. Let's bring in Tim Powers, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data, and here now. Tim, hope you're doing well.
Well, Scott, I'm okay. I mean, I'm a bit depressed with the new capital gains taxes they're going to put in there. But apparently, they're only going to affect 0.13% of Canadians. But we'll see. That often isn't the case.
How do you balance all of this? Apparently, this is good for the young people that have been leaving their party in droves. Will they like it? Does this change anything from that younger demographic?
Well, we haven't seen that in the polls, right? You and I talked about this last week. Our Abacus poll came out last Thursday after about 2 weeks of doing this, and Liberals were behind by 20 points nationally and behind in every region. Clearly, yes, Prime Minister and Minister Freeland making a big play that the housing investments that they're making, the investments in rental arrangements are going to pay off with Gen Z and millennials. I'm far too early to say. I can just tell you that over the last 2 weeks, and nothing really super new in that regard has been announced, to the best of my knowledge, other than them announcing today they would, I think, free up more federal lands and federal properties like office buildings to build space. So, you know, there's not much new on that front that was out that hadn't moved the needle. We'll see if it moves the needle.
Obviously, targeting certain groups, younger people, how does that make the rest of us feel? Does that, you know, are you robbing Peter to pay Paul here?
Scott, you know, you and I just may as well check, kick it. You know, we're not the target group. You and I, men of white men of a certain age, are not who this government's trying to appeal to. And fair enough, people will argue we've been appealed to for a long period of time. But yeah, young people, look, they're going back there. Certainly, they're, you know, the middle class and those are hoping to join it. There are no tax increases, so to speak, for the so-called middle class. Again, we can fight over how you define that, which again, I think is an important group, depending how you break it down for the Liberals. But a lot of those people are feeling the affordability pinch. And some of the early reactions from bank economists have been that there might be too much spending here that'll make the Bank of Canada's job more difficult, because as we know, there is a link between too much spending and the inflation rate. And that if you've got a variable mortgage, then you're renegotiating this summer. You're hoping that will go down in June a little bit, but there seems to, look, we'll see what happens in June with that. But the spending may create further affordability challenges, prolong the affordability crisis.
I didn't listen to everything word for word today because I've been on the air. I've been hearing excerpts of it. I'm not sure how many times the middle class was mentioned or those that are trying to join the middle class. We remember at one time there used to be a minister of the middle class. Has Canada realized that rather than talking so much and helping the middle class so much, that this government has done more to decimate the middle class? And you don't have to listen to me. And let's be honest here, Tim, if the middle class cannot afford homes, if your kids can't afford homes, how is the middle class growing? And why would anybody want to join it? He's done the opposite to the middle class. Is that accurate?
Well, to join the Scott Thompson parade, I was actually dropping my accounting material off to my accountant today, terrified of what may come back. And on the way back, I was listening to CFRA here in Ottawa, and they were running with a story about now to buy a house, the average home price in Ottawa was about $676,000. Their calculation that was made, somebody would need to have at least $134,000 to buy a house here. But in your neck of the woods, Toronto, earning $134,000 a year. But in your neck of the woods, Toronto and elsewhere, it was much higher than that. A lot of young people aren't making that kind of money. And by the time they make that kind of money, lo and behold, unless something is course corrected, it's going to cost, their homes will cost more, and they will need to make more to buy that home that is now $676,000.
So what happens now, Tim? Because as Pierre Poilievre so pointed out today, there's still another year and a half of this. What happens now? I mean, what if this all falls flat, the numbers continue where they are or continue to drop in the next month or so, or even beyond that? I mean, what is the next year and a half? What is in store for Canadians?
It's a great question, right? So there's, look, the Liberals, I think, are hoping that these measures will take off. and that in the meantime, the economy will improve, that inflation will start to shrink. Although it went up today to 2.9%, up a little bit. So they're hoping there'll be an economic rebound, that these measures, particularly around housing, that houses will be able to be built in the next year and a bit, that some people will get housed, that they'll feel gratitude for all of that and they'll support the Liberals. But I think, look, the harsh thing here for the Liberal Party will be this, Scott. If we are a month from now, so lots of time for people to consume the budget, and the numbers haven't moved, both the Prime Minister, if he hasn't moved off, and the Liberals are going to have to do some serious soul searching about, all right, you know, do we believe what we're trying to sell ourselves? And are all the assumptions that we're making are not starting to happen? Do we need to look at something else? But I think they're going to hold firm for now and hope things improve on a hope and a prayer, Scott.
Tim Powers with us, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data, and the budget, how it will play out. Tim, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
Take care, buddy.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
Lots to talk to Peter Grafe about, professor of political science, McMaster University, whether it's the budget just announced or Highway 403 moving forward now. Let's bring in Peter Grafe, professor of political science, McMaster University. He is here now. Peter, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, thanks. Hope you're well, too.
Before we get into this, what about your thoughts on the budget? I don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of all that. Mind you, we've heard a lot of it already, but your thoughts on the long 3-week rollout and it geared specifically to those younger voters that, that the party's lost in the last election or so.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's Christmas Day for political scientists when the budget comes out. I mean, I think the 3-week rollout is really an indication of, you know, what governments have been doing increasingly with budgets, where there's no surprise or not much surprise on budget day, because it's really, it's a long-term public relations exercise. And in this case, it's a Liberal government that's not very high in the polls, that's trying its best to really get and squeeze any bit of good news out of its announcements. So yeah, that's not a huge surprise there. We might have expected a bit more. I mean, the language is all about how this is for young people, but really it's a bunch of housing measures. Like, obviously that's a really key concern for millennials and Generation Z, but you know, beyond those measures, there's not a lot in this budget that speaks specifically to that generation. So you know, we'll deal with people who are looking or having troubles finding housing, you know, regardless of their age. There's not much that's specifically for younger people in that.
Normally when budgets come out, we certainly hear of leaks and such and the odd bonbon thrown out there a couple of days before, but to do it one every day for the first 3 weeks leading up to it, they've insisted, the party, Liberal Party, that this is a comms problem, a communications problem. Is it that the voting public doesn't understand their policy, or is it they just don't like the message?
Well, or, you know, the third option, they're tired of a government that's been there for a long time, or, you know, 8 or 9 years. And I think in a way this rollout maybe also, you know, reflects a bit of a tired government that seems to, you know, promise, as in any budget, it delivers all kinds of things because, you know, there's all sorts of problems that need to be resolved. But, you know, despite spending 3 weeks rolling out these promises, I'm not sure that many registered, because it's, you know, a different promise every day, not unlike some, you know, election campaigns, which, you know, sometimes called, you know, Gainsburger, where a bit of, you know, pet food is brought out every day for the voters. Huh. But at the end of it, the voters don't always know really what that government or party is standing for. And I think in this instance, you know, they'll get some sense about the emphasis on doing things around housing. But beyond that, there's not a lot of kind of a clear narrative coming out of this particular budget.
Obviously, we're guessing that Jagmeet Singh and the federal NDP are going to approve this. That was all talked about ahead of time. Very interesting tweet from Jagmeet Singh. It says, breaking, the conservative handouts continue. Justin Trudeau will keep Pierre Poilievre's $60 billion in taxpayer handouts to corporations. Thanks to Pierre and Justin, it's a good day for greedy Galen Weston and a bad day for you. How long can Jagmeet Singh keep playing this card and yet not do anything about it, because he is the one person who can. And he's almost portraying Pierre Poilievre and Justin Trudeau as teammates, as opposed to the real teammates, which are Jagmeet Singh and Justin Trudeau. Can he complain if he can really change all of this, or has the leverage to do so?
Well, I mean, he has leverage as long as that government is in place. I think that's the situation in which he finds himself. You're right, Canadians may not find some of his posturing entirely credible. But presumably he's playing to a part of the electorate that either, you know, wants to support the NDP or would move between the NDP and the Liberals. And so it remains a kind of a crucial political for his political survival in the next election to maintain some difference, to say that the NDP is supporting this budget because it contains some things that they support, but to insist that somehow he is not on the Liberal team. And, you know, as you point out, that kind of strains the credibility of Mr. Singh with a lot of Canadians. Others maybe sort of see it as, you know, what is the realistic leverage of the NDP in a minority government situation?
Either way, it certainly looks as if this government is going to run its course. It'll go for another year and a half.
Yeah, I would think. Certainly it's going to survive this budget. And it's not really clear at what point you would expect the NDP to pull the plug. So, yeah, if it was to not go to the full length, it would be if the Liberals suddenly saw a bump in the polls and saw they had some momentum that they could take advantage of in the campaign. But, you know, I think this budget is a clear sign that an important constituency of theirs, sort of younger voters and millennial voters, are unhappy with how the Liberals have dealt with the housing crisis. And they're trying to woo back those voters. That would be a first step in building a viable path to victory for the Liberals in the next federal election. We'll see if any of this registers. I'm a bit skeptical.
Are you surprised the NDP can't take more advantage of the Liberals' downfall?
Well, I think the way they maybe take advantage is if the Liberals really fall far enough down. At the moment, I think the polling shows that a significant chunk of Mr. Singh's voters are actually more likely to be voting for the Liberals at the moment.
Yeah, because he's down too.
Yeah, right. And so the Liberals are really running on this idea that it's them or the Conservatives, and that's historically been a successful way for them to pull NDP votes. The only time it really goes the other way, the example would be 2011, where the Liberals get so weak that Liberal voters who want to stop the election of a Conservative party move towards the NDP. And that worked for Mr. Layton in 2011. But, you know, short of that kind of Liberal collapse, the NDP is really in a hard spot just trying to prevent its own voters from voting Liberals to try and head off Mr. Poilievre.
All right. We wanted to talk to you about the 413. We got about 30 seconds left. Are you surprised that the conflict between the feds and the provinces has pretty much disappeared and this is moving forward after all the commotion that was caused?
I was more surprised in the first case when the federal government decided to get involved in this. But I think it is maybe a sign that the voters that they hope to maybe be able to pick up in places like Milton and Vaughan are ones that are probably Conservative Liberal switchers. And so there's benefit to be seen on Doug Ford's side on this project in those specific ridings.
Peter Griff with us, Professor of Political Science, McMaster University. Always fascinating, Peter. Thanks for the time. Be well.
And you too.
You know, I'm trying to dissect the budget here. One thing I found, other than housing, stiffer penalties for car theft. Boy, if you're in law enforcement, you must be howling at this one. This from the Catch and Release Prime Minister. Remember, like 600 cars in the Port of Montreal, just reports on that a couple of weeks ago. Now it's time for stiffer penalties. Man, there's so much of closing the door after the barn door, after the horse is already out into the field. It's amazing. But I can't wait to get Franco Terrazano's impression of all of this. He's with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, federal director here now. Franco, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I love that intro music you had on for me.
We're hammering it out here, Franco. So what are your thoughts on this? I mean, I'm not sure who this appeals to. They say it appeals to the younger generation. I'm not sure this is going to resonate. What are your thoughts?
It's awful. It's a complete disaster. It's a complete disaster. Okay, so like they're trying to frame this whole budget as fairness for all generations, for future generations. Well, guess what, folks? It's official. This year, the Trudeau government will have officially doubled the entire federal debt. Doubled the federal debt in what, 8 or 9 years? Isn't that crazy? But you know what? It's not just impacting future generations. It's impacting us right now, because this year, interest charges on the debt will cost us $54 billion. So the interest charges on that huge federal debt tab is costing Canadian taxpayers more than $1 billion every single week. And it's also more money than what the federal government will send to the provinces in health transfers.
That's that really resonates when you say something like that. So taxing the rich and business, we understand, to pay for all of this. How do you mention business when the Bank of Canada, you know, tap the glass, there's an emergency here, productivity, innovation, investment all down?
Well, they're just chasing away investment. They're chasing away investment with this capital gains tax. Like, what are they doing, right? This is so economically damaging. But there's two rationales that they gave in the budget, okay? Number one is they're trying to make, I don't know, they say that they want to make the taxation more fair, more in line with income taxes. Well, then just cut income taxes. There you go. Solution solved. Keep more money in people's pockets. The second thing they say here is that they got to figure out a way, you know, to stay fiscally responsible. I almost laughed while I said that out loud, because here's the thing. I crunched the numbers, and the money that they bring in through the capital gains tax from taxpayers, the way that they're spending money, they would blow through that extra cash in less than a week. In less than a week, right? This government has a spending problem. It doesn't have a revenue problem. Honestly, Scott, between me and you, I think that they could win the lottery every single day and still max out the credit card.
Does this produce results? Will certain segments of the population be relieved by this?
Well, I think it's going to keep interest rates and inflation high. That's what I think, right? That's exactly what I think. Now, here's what we heard Freeland last year. In her last budget, she said that they would find $15 billion in savings over a handful of years. Well, they're increasing spending this year by $37 billion. You know, pro tip for any politicians listening to the show here, if you increase spending by more than $30 billion in 1 year, you're saving money wrong.
Former Bank of Canada, David Dodge, well-respected, been in politics for a long time as well, consulting, what have you. He called this yesterday the worst budget since 1982 of Pierre Elliott Trudeau. How do you make that comparison? Is that accurate?
I don't think he's too far off. You know what I mean? Like, every year they set the bar very high in terms of worst budget. And every year they seem to surpass that already high bar. This is a very, very bad budget, okay? $54 billion in interest charges, more than $1 billion a week going to pay interest on the federal debt. The deficit is $40 billion, folks. Like, we're not in a pandemic. How in the world can they be running a $40 billion deficit? Not only that, they have absolutely no plan to ever balance the budget. The best that they can do for us taxpayers is like, hey, in a couple of years, we'll bring down the deficit to $20 billion. It is getting so out of control. Like I said, they have no plan to balance the budget. They have no plan to actually save money. The only plan that this government has is to take as much money from taxpayers that they can get away with.
Are you surprised at the reaction to Jagmeet Singh? I'm reading a tweet right now from him. It says, the conservative handouts will continue. Justin Trudeau will keep Pierre Poilievre's $60 billion in taxpayer handouts to corporations. Thanks to Pierre and Justin, it's a good day for greedy Galen Weston and a bad day for you. It's amazing that he's trying to paint a picture of Pierre Poilievre and Justin Trudeau being on the same team, when in fact it's him that's propping up this government and really is the only one that can change all of this.
Yeah, you know, I am so happy I'm not in Mr. Singh's comm shop. You know what I mean? Like, there ain't any money that you could pay me to be doing that thing, let me tell you. But you know what? There is a ton of corporate welfare in this budget. I mean, essentially, if you're a company and you say green or clean, the government is writing you a check. That's essentially kind of what's going on. I mean, we already heard, right? we already know that the federal government has given tens of billions of dollars to multinational corporations to build these EV plants. I mean, that's one of the big things that the government has to cut back on is the corporate welfare. Obviously, we'd want to scrap it altogether, just cut taxes, cut red tape to grow the economy. But the other area of the budget that the government really has to tackle, and I don't mean just like a little bit, I mean really have to tackle, is the ballooning bureaucracy, right? About half of the government's day-to-day spending is being consumed by the bureaucracy. And the Trudeau government has already increased the size of the federal government employee payroll by 100,000 additional bureaucrats since taking over in 2015-16, a 40% increase almost. So, I mean, there are so much areas in this budget that has to be cut. But unfortunately, instead of actually finding savings, they're increasing spending by like $37 billion this year.
Do you think Canadians are going to pay more attention to this budget, Franco, because it took 3 weeks to roll out as opposed to just like 3 days or, you know, a budget day and then a couple of leaks here and there? They always thought it was a communications issue, not the message itself. A 3 week rollout, has this made it clear to Canadians what this government's all about?
Well, I think Canadians are just sick and tired of the federal government wasting our money and like just not even being serious about the state of our national finances. Right. Like, I think Canadians could probably forgive someone if they make a mistake once. Right. But this government has like proven time and again that it doesn't really care about fiscal responsibility. It doesn't care about the state of national finances, and it doesn't care about providing taxpayers with relief. That's really the only way that we can really put it here. You know, a $40 billion deficit when there is no pandemic, it's 2024 now, is mind-boggling. Like, I honestly don't know how they can even run up such a huge credit card bill. But it's also costing Canadians dearly, right? Because think about it this way, folks. How much money does it cost to build a hospital? Like $1 billion? Well, the federal government is wasting away that money every single week on debt interest charges.
We've got to endure this for another year and a half, it looks like.
Well, you know what? If you're listening to the show and you're fed up with this and you're fed up with the crazy spending and you're fed up with your tax bill always going up, you got to take action. And, you know, now would be the perfect time to pick up a phone, write an email to your member of parliament, because they are all worried about how Canadians and you will be taking their budget and say, hey, enough is enough. Get off the gravy train.
Franco Terrazano with us, Canadian Taxpayers Federation Federal Director, commenting on today's budget. Franco, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Coming up after the 6 o'clock news, Scott Radley Show. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am.
I'm going to read you this tweet because I know you'll just flip out. This
I know where you're going. I know.
Jagmeet Singh's tweet?
I saw it, and it's...
It's absolutely incredible. This man doesn't even know who is in power anymore. Forget asking him if he wants to be prime minister, which I ask him every time he's on my show. Clearly, he doesn't, but he doesn't even know who's running the country. Here's his breaking tweet. This was of 1 hour ago when the budget was all hitting the fan. The conservative handouts will continue. Justin Trudeau will keep Pierre Poilievre's $60 billion in taxpayer handouts to corporations. Thanks to Pierre and Justin, it's a good day for greedy Galen Weston and a bad day for you. He's actually, you know, you talk about low information voters. This is who both of these guys, meaning Justin and Jagmeet, are catering to. Like, I mean, he's trying to move away from the fact that it is him that is propping up the government and trying to make it sound like Justin and Pierre are a team.
Jagmeet Singh at this point could only hope to one day rise to the level of low information. Jagmeet Singh has become the biggest...
It's just become an embarrassment. It really has.
He has become the biggest satirical figure. Like, you would think this has to be all a big joke that he's playing, because there is no conceivable way that a man who has the power single-handedly to topple this government, force an election, and undo the things that he says are all the problems, he alone has that power. There is no way that a man in that position can possibly, with a straight face, say the thing he does unless he is truly clueless. And I don't think he's a dumb man, but he's making a good case.
And we let's be honest, we know the real reason that he's this is because he cannot become prime minister. He's the only person in the country that's less popular than the prime minister is Jagmeet Singh. He's down 2 points at the expense of or as the result of the Liberals. So, you know, it's obvious why he's doing it. But boy, oh, boy, you got to wonder, once these guys are gone, their parties, how are they going to rebuild?
Well, think of something else when the election eventually comes along, whenever that is.
I think both will be gone. Both Jagmeet and Justin are going to be gone. I can't see them continuing.
But here's the thing. You would think that when an election comes along, if everything stays the way it is, those two would have their cannons focused on Pierre Poilievre taking aim at him. Problem is, they can't now because they're so tied at the hip. They're going to have to fight each other to show how they're different to get the left-wing voters. So Poilievre is not going to face nearly the slings and arrows that he normally would in an election like this, because they're going to be beating up on each other. The whole thing is so nonsensical that at this point, like, Jagmeet Singh truly has become a satire. Every time he opens his mouth, it's like, did you fall and hit your head? Like, how do you not get that you are the only guy that can fix this, yet you're doing the most complaining?
You could be the superhero.
Yeah.
You talk about strong mayor's powers. Boy, this person, my goodness, it would be huge for them.
But you're right. That he is smart enough, because I don't think he's a dumb man, even though he does a lot of dumb things.
If he was really smart, he'd be a liberal, but I digress.
Well, if he was really smart, maybe he wouldn't have gone into politics. Just would have stayed as a lawyer. But the reality is that he knows, you're absolutely right, he knows that if he triggers an election, the apocalypse is coming. For him and for the Liberals. You also can't say we're supporting the Liberals. So what do you do if Harry Neal, remember the hockey broadcaster, Harry Neal? Yep. Harry Neal had a great line. Most people have heard it once upon a time when he was coaching. He says, our problem is we can't win at home and we can't win on the road. And we haven't found anywhere else to play. And Jagmeet Singh is now essentially in that position. We can't support the Liberals, but we can't support the Conservatives, and we can't not support the Liberals. And we haven't figured out where else that leaves an opening for us.
So what's next? Because, you know, I was listening to Pierre Poilievre earlier this morning before the budget came out. He was holding a newser and he said, it looks like this is going to go, which means Jagmeet's going to support it. So what do we do for the next year and a half?
Hold on.
Because this is a budget for electing. He's not going to do this again.
It's going to be worse next time, Scott. It's going to be bigger next time. This is every year. You could probably go back, and I don't have any numbers in front of me to support this. I'm going by just, memory but every year that you run up to an election, the governing party always spends more. They always do. They always throw out more goodies. So what's more? Well, I know what's more than this. It's a lot. But next year, if we are getting to a budget that in an election year, that's going to be even bigger than this one, like, holy moly. And the idea, I thought it was so interesting. We're going to talk about this in the first hour of the show. It's so interesting that they're positioning this as a budget for generational fairness. And yet what they're doing is strapping the future generations that they claim to be helping with so much debt. That as Franco, who was on with you before, is saying, we're paying $1 billion in debt service charges every week. That's money that could go to hospitals, roads, whatever programs. But no, we just have to throw it away. And it's only going to get bigger. And those generations that they claim that they're helping are the ones who are going to be holding the bag for that.
How do you like socialism now? Justin Trudeau taking the center-left party to the extreme left, and that's what we've been living for the last 8 years or so, and the result of that. Why would you want to vote for Jagmeet Singh? You've already had this. You've already had the left.
If Jagmeet Singh is going to go further left, like if the NDP, and I'm not being facetious here, like if their position is that we are the left-wing party, that we are the progressive party, and we have to out-progressive where the Liberals have been governing from, you are essentially now at a table with Che Guevara. I mean, you are like so far out there that there's not much left. You could fall off the face of the earth if you take two more steps.
All right, you're getting pulled back right there. Scott Radley coming back coming on after the 6 o'clock news. Read them in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online. online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one from Mike. Most Canadians struggle at the end of each month to pay the bills, allow for groceries and gasoline, and try to maintain a healthy household budget. Yet our federal government spends money as if it grows on trees. They spend, we pay the piper. Enough. Keep right, except to pass.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.